This week's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast is brought to you by the Wind Up Watch Shop. In the Wind Up Watch Shop, you'll find an array of exciting, innovating brands offering watches that appeal to a wide variety of tastes and styles. From quartz watches with impeccable design and detailing, to one-of-a-kind mechanical timepieces with tech unlike anything you've ever seen before, the Wind Up Watch Shop has something for everyone. So head over to www.windupwatchshop.com. That's www.windupwatchshop.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the Worn and Wound podcast. This week's episode is a bit of a special one. At Wind Up Watch Fair in April, we brought together three Worn and Wound podcast alumni, Jason Lim from Helios, Bradley Price from Autodromo, and Etienne Malik from Baltic, to participate in a bit of a power panel about running a successful brand in 2019. We covered a whole bunch of topics, from the loaded nature of the term microbrand to the challenges of the current, sometimes oversaturated market. If you want us to cover something on a future episode of the podcast, then be sure to hit us up via email at info@wornandwound.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, then please leave us a review on iTunes. It goes a long way in helping us grow the show. Thanks. Hey everyone, this is Ilya, and joining me on the podcast this week is my co-host Zach.
Hey guys.
And we have a bit of a power panel here today. We have Bradley from Autodromo.
Hello.
Jason Lim from Helios.
Hello.
And Etienne Malik from Baltic.
Hello.
So I think what we're going to do with this episode is we're going to have a discussion about what it's like running a watch brand. And Jason, you've been around the longest. Bradley, you're the next one up. And Etienne, you've been around for just a couple of years.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that we want to sort of get into like what are the challenges of running a brand, how has the scene sort of changed, especially in the microbrand space. And I also want it to be a bit of a conversation, not just with us, but amongst you three. Because I think like you all have probably similar experiences, but also very different ones. And I think it'd be fun to get into all of that. So before we get into that conversation, let's do a quick wrist check. Bradley, why don't you tell us what you're wearing?
I'm wearing the Group B Series 2 with the metal bracelet. I'm actually wearing it's actually a production watch. It's just not out yet. It's going to be coming out in June. We have a new color of the Group B. It's a bright blue dial. So wearing that today.
I've seen a lot of people already taking photos of it and showing it to me and being like, oh yeah, that's the one I'm going to get.
So. I told everyone not to post pictures of it.
Yeah.
But we'll see who breaks the embargo.
Jason?
Well, I'm buying that first Autodromo, by the way, just so you know. On my left wrist, I've got the Pastel Dial Universa prototype. On my right wrist, I have the Brew Watches Retrograph in Technicolor.
Double wristing, nice.
Absolutely. Yeah.
On my wrist, I got the new Equescaf Black and Silver Dial that we're going to ship in June coming. And I don't have a second watch on my right wrist today, unfortunately.
And I am wearing the Stova Partidio Limited Edition that we released last fall, one of my regular travel watches.
And I am wearing a limited edition Young Hands Max Bill that was gifted to me yesterday by the Worn and Wound crew. And this one's kind of cool because it has a...
Nice present.
And this one's cool because it has a sapphire crystal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that what makes it the limited edition?
Or well, it's also celebrating, I think, an anniversary, right?
Yeah, every year Young Hands does several limited editions and there's usually a kit. So this one also, it comes with the winding clock, which I believe is also going to be in the office as part of the... And it has a special edition case back with some original Max Bill art on it, which is really cool. But yeah, this one has a sapphire crystal, which I remember last year, Basel. Ilya was particularly really into as a owner of another Max Bill that I believe he might have hit a wall at some point, you know. So
that's awesome because I was just up there a few minutes ago and I saw the tribute to Bauhaus, which is phenomenal with the red date and the case back.
Yeah,
and the darkened case.
So yeah, actually, this is a good place to start. But so it's day three of Wind Up. You may be able to hear in our voices we're all a bit tired. But how's the show been going for you guys? Are you having a good time?
Yes,
seen anything awesome?
We're not tired, Zach.
No, we're wide awake. No, it's been great. It's been a good show. I mean, the San Francisco people are really happy to be here. They're always happy that Worn and Wound brings this show here. So we just get a lot of people saying thank you for doing this and bringing this here. So
far, it's actually pretty good for us as well because this is one of the first time that we show the Equescaf this year. So a lot of people coming, asking questions, checking it in person, which was one of the main lag we have, you know, on the website sometimes when we do pre-orders. So it was a good way to show it to other people. And it's pretty cool because, you know, in New York, there's a lot of people coming, just passing by a little bit. Here, we take a little bit of more time to have a chat with everyone. So it's pretty cool to be in San Francisco this year again.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Glad you guys are all enjoying it. It's been a really good show, too. Like, you know, last year was the first time we did San Francisco, and the difference between the 2 years, I think, has been noticeable. It's a much higher energy show this
year.
Yeah,
they were literally at capacity yesterday. They had to stop letting people in, so.
We're not the fire marshals, so, you know.
It's getting famous.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know there was a lineup.
Yeah.
I'm stuck down in the basement, so.
Yeah.
No, but, I mean, it's been fantastic. Like, we've had tons of great conversations, and it was kind of, it's weird. In New York, it's more of a general audience simply yep. because of the location. Here, it's very much very focused, very directed. Today, we have a bit more of, you know, just folks just strolling by the area. But yesterday and the first day, it's been like, you know, watch enthusiasts. They come specifically to see certain brands. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that they want to see.
They spend the whole day in the actual fair, which is crazy. You know, there's
yes.
not a
yes.
lot of brands, but still they work all day long here, which is pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, that's true. And they come back multiple days.
Yeah, for sure. So, Jason, I'm going to start with you. When was Halios founded?
2009.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what was the space like then? Obviously, there weren't shows like this. The world of, like, internet watchdom was much smaller than it is now. What was it like starting a brand back in 2009?
Well, most of the brands in my world, they were kind of birthed on the watch forums.
Mm-hmm.
So, Time Zone, Watch You Seek, which are still around now. And there are a few brands that were started then that don't exist now. Some are still around, like Time Factors, Raven, still around. I know Steve from way back, so we're just joking about how we were the oldest guys at the show. We certainly didn't have any sort of show like what Wind Up is back then. And also, there are enthusiast gatherings, but not as frequently. We didn't have Red Bar back then. So that I think that was the landscape back then.
And, like, what were the challenges, I guess, starting it up back then? I feel like probably the infrastructure was not as vast as it is now, right? Even if, like, dealing with manufacturers, it must have been, like, the wild, wild west back in the day.
Yeah, I'm definitely convinced of the fact that manufacturers today, accessible to, let's say, a microbrand or startup, mm-hmm. have vastly superior capabilities than back then. You know, stuff that's available to somebody starting, like, a 300-watch run or something like that. So they had the trade shows back then as well. You could tour the factories, but I think the capabilities weren't developed in factories that were accessible to a startup.
Mm-hmm.
So there have always been factories that are amazing. Mm-hmm. They've always been there. It's just that they were not as open to dealing with, you know, a startup.
Right. And Bradley, what was your experience like when you got started? And what year was that?
We launched in 2011.
Okay.
November of 2011. I was never really active on watch forums or anything like that. I didn't come from like a background of being super nerding out on watches. I was more of a, you know, car nerd and also an industrial designer. So mm-hmm. I just had the idea that there was a lack of automotive watches at an affordable price point and that were like tastefully designed. So that was kind of where I started from.
But did you read forums a little bit or not at all?
Not really.
Not really?
Okay. No.
Do you read them now?
No. I absolutely don't read them now. I don't read car forums either now.
Yeah.
I just don't care. I think it's a great way to ruin your day, honestly. Things changed a lot. I think that was an interesting comment you made about the factory capability, also the access to factories. Like, I had no idea how to go about this, so I had someone tell me you should just go to the Hong Kong Watch and Clock Show and just walk around and talk to factories and show, you know, bring your designs, like print it out and just sit down and talk to people. I think that there, you know, it's not that people didn't take you seriously. They did. They want business, right? But I think today you see OEMs that are really actively courting micro brands and they want that kind of business.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas back then, if you weren't like Boulevard or something, it was a little bit less like interest from the factories to get started. So you had to have a bigger run. You had to kind of prove that you were serious
mm-hmm.
and you had to like kind of go there. I think today, and unfortunately there's a lot of people that even are just sourcing junk on Alibaba without ever even talking to anyone. But you know, that kind of thing wasn't happening as far as I know back then.
Right. And Etienne, what about you? When was Baltic founded? In 2000?
So Baltic was founded in 2017.
Okay.
The Kickstarter in April. So it's pretty young. Although the project for sure was developed like 2 years before that. So it was actually like pretty complicated as well for me to find good manufacturer because now there is a lot. And you actually never knows what's the quality, what's, I don't know, the experience you're going to have with the manufacturer is very important, I think. And sometimes I think that just going to the Hong Kong clock fair isn't enough to have a proper, you know, to be really sure that it's going to be the one. Mm-hmm. So I tried to, you know, speak with other brands. And one guy from France actually gave me a contact of a guy. He's a Frenchman working in Hong Kong. And the contact was really good with him. I knew that the guy had experiences because he's working for much bigger brands. So I was, okay, let's test that. And we compared to another manufacturer and the quality was just like sun and, you know, mm-hmm. like it was completely different, the opposite. So we were, okay, let's give a shot with that guy and we'll see how it goes. But yeah, manufacturing is definitely one of the main thing you need to figure it out before to go, because it's quality-wise, it's the most important. So you really need to focus on that.
Do you guys find that now, in addition to, I mean, obviously, like you're saying, Jason, the capabilities growing, that are there a lot more manufacturers? Has the industry kind of built up around the sector a little bit more?
Yeah,
I guess.
Yep, I concur.
I think there's definitely more mainland Chinese OEMs that have popped up in the last 10 years compared to the more established. I think people really don't understand the difference between Hong Kong OEM versus a mainland Chinese OEM as well, because like in Hong Kong, that there's a much longer history of making watches. I mean, our company that we use has been in business for 40 years. So they have like a huge amount of technical expertise and they're also, they have a reputation. So they can't just do shady stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to also look at the reputation of the company and not just the immediate kind of what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm sure that there are also some great mainland Chinese factories, but it's just a bit more of a Wild West thing there
jungle.
At the moment.
You mean Wild East?
Wild East, sorry. Wild Far East, yes.
And they actually try to reach you, you know. I guess you guys as well receive many emails, you know, from manufacturers that try to actually get you.
Yeah. Yeah, we get weird DMs and WhatsApp contacts and all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
So it's pretty, yeah, wild, definitely.
Yeah. I've seen my own watches that were actually your photos, worn and wound photos.
Not my fault.
That were stolen and they were on some OEM's website, like you could like order this watch.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like, oh my
I'd
God.
Say probably once or twice a year we get an email from a reader or another brand saying like, yo, your photos are being used on Alibaba to sell something else. And you know,
it's pretty usual.
Frankly, we cared at first and now there's no fighting it. Yeah. So, you know, actually something, you know, talks also with the growth and capabilities, you know, I feel like it's something you kind of hear, particularly from brands starting out who aren't making massive orders, but that there's always this kind of push and pull with factories. Do you find now that the factories are working more to actually create the designs that you want? Because I'm thinking actually with the watches, like the three of you are wearing, you know, you have an exceptionally finished watch on, all three of you do, but with some complicated geometry in them and finishing in them that, you know, we were remarking the other day, like, in 2011, when we first started doing this, you weren't seeing really, you know, the complexity of the cases are dramatically increased. Do you just, is it a matter of your ability to communicate, or do you think the factories are literally more willing to kind of work with you on them?
Well, I'm feeling that, you know, any brand that has to occupy a certain price point space, there is some of designing around the capabilities of your OEM, of your manufacturers. But what I'm finding with a better quality or better, not better quality, but a more capable supplier, they will be more able to execute what you want to do. Something as simple as, let's say, a bevel on the case or a polishing in a spot. So I don't think communication is an issue for me, at least. I tell them exactly what I want. But you know, I think you know it does depend on the factory, I think. It does depend on your component supplier as to what their capabilities are.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I do all the CAD for all of our watches, but the engineer that I work with at our OEM is really brilliant. And I like to challenge her with, like, how could we do this? Or, you know, when we did the Ford GT owner's watch, there was a huge amount of complexity with that watch in terms of the stack up of all the layers of the dial, making sure that they all had the proper amount of clearance. All these things, which of course I can get there with the CAD, but I don't have the expertise to say like, okay, really how much gap do we need between these parts and the top crystal and so on. And they understand all these things at a much higher level. I could never have made that watch just by myself. But I also, I wouldn't have just like farmed it out to, you know, I've never like just asked, hey, send me some designs. You know, I feel like anyone who's saying to their factory, send me some design, shouldn't be in this business, frankly.
Definitely.
Oh yeah, definitely. No, and I hope I didn't, you know, mean that.
No, but there are people that are definitely doing that. I mean, and you can usually, I just feel like, what's the point? Like, why are you doing this then?
But I've definitely seen, you know, in the past, brands, you know, it kind of seems like they're being told what their limitations are to a degree that doesn't seem realistic. Like you see a 14 millimeter case with a Miyota 9-15 in it or something, and it's in the, with a 30 millimeter water resistance. You're like, why did you make it that way? Oh, we were told that's the only way we could do it. It's like, well, something happened there, you know? And I just feel like I don't see that as much anymore. Now, like the watches in this fair are pretty exceptional, and there's just, there aren't outliers where it's like, you know, what happened there? You know? Yeah. So
I got to jump in because Bradley mentioned the Ford GT watch. So if you ever have a chance to check it out at a show, definitely do so. But the best part is having Bradley actually explain the case and construction to you. It's freaking awesome.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
Another level, definitely.
Etienne, you touched on something that I kind of want to explore a little bit. And that was that you reached out to another brand and you got a contact with a manufacturer.
Yeah.
And it's this idea of collaboration. So how big is collaboration within this space?
Well, I guess it depends on the people, for sure. You know, some of the people will be able to collaborate with you because they want, you know, to help a little bit the community of small watch brand owners. Some they don't want because they want to keep their secret for themselves, for sure, which is legit as well. But in my case, it was pretty cool because the guy was really open and is, you know, experienced guy, 50 years old, and he was like, this community has to grow. You know, the small brands has to be the brands of tomorrow, because we feel a little bit that, you know, there must be a change in the industry a little bit. I think that people are now more interested than ever in brands like us because they want to find something a little bit different. Maybe before they were a little bit shy or they feared that it wasn't, you know, the quality wasn't enough maybe or something like this. But now we know that we could, you know, do almost the same than much, much bigger brand. So now people are looking for something different, something a little bit more human. They can have a talk with us on Instagram, in the fairs. It's pretty open. It's much more simple, you know, in human way, I think. And definitely one of the thing is, I think that there is a sense of win-win when it comes to smaller brands because we are not having the same structure than the bigger one. It's much more, I don't know, simple. So people have the feeling that, you know, it's very, like, I don't know.
It's personal, right?
It's personal.
It's a personal thing.
Yeah. I mean, when you go to, you know, like, if you buy a Rolex, you probably not have a personal experience at all, kind of. And I like this brand, but the fact is, you know, there is a disconnection between the brand and the people. And here, I think it's totally the opposite. So
yeah, I mean, we see that here at the show. It's like part of the conceit of the show is that people are showing up and talking to the people behind the brands, not a PR person.
Yeah,
not somebody who's not going to be here 3 months from now, but it's somebody who's really the driving force of the company. Both.
And it's actually interesting because it's the case for the people, for the customers. But I think it's also the case for the brand owners. You know, like, I'm not sure we are shy to, you know, sharing information because we know that it's a growing market and we have to be together instead of, you know, like being more, I don't know, competitive. I think we all have our thing, kind of. All brands here are different. We are not, you know, stepping on each other. So I think it's definitely worse the shot to help each other than doing the opposite, definitely.
You know what's really funny? Usually in trade shows and conventions and stuff, like if you're from one booth and you go look at somebody else's booth, they're like, arrest you and drag you out. And it's like, what are you doing? You're stealing my idea.
Yeah.
But like if I'm going to Etienne's booth or Bradley's booth, it's like, I want to see the new cool stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's that. I think Windup has been really important in bringing the independent, what are we calling ourselves? Enthusiast brand.
I like independent brands more than micro brand.
Okay, I don't mind micro brand, but it seems to have become some sort of like bad word or something. Mm. I embrace it.
I wouldn't say it's a bad word, but
yeah, enthusiast brand. You would say it's a bad word?
I said I wouldn't say it's a bad word, but I think it's
a packed word.
Yeah, it's loaded now to some degree.
But some owners apparently don't like it. Like they get insulted if you know.
Oh really?
I'm not a micro brand. I'm a, you know. But what, anyway, my point was.
No, but yeah, enthusiast is.
We've heard that. We've been told by brands, like, we'd rather you didn't call us a micro brand.
Yeah, but I mean, what I was going to say is Windup has been instrumental, at least for me, in bringing me closer to other watch brand owners. And I've actually made a ton of, like, true friends, not just like, hey, how's it going? Like, people that I would actually help if they ever needed. And I know who'd actually help me and would share information if need be. But, you know.
Yeah, and that's great. And, you know. I love seeing that. That's like an unintended but wonderful side effect of all this, you know, because, you know, we obviously, when we first thought of doing this, it wasn't necessarily that Jason would be able to make friends. And it's great that Jason...
I finally found friends.
Yeah. But, you know, hanging out with you guys, like, you know, we went to dinner with a group of people last night, and it's like, you know, I think, and it's going beyond just looking at each other's stuff and sharing pointers. It seems like there's a larger sort of group support network, which being that buying power in smaller brands is smaller, like all these things, like it's all going somewhere really fantastic, you know, which I think is exciting to see. And the exact opposite of sort of what the larger industry seems to go for, which is, you know, in-house, get out of our house kind of a mentality.
So let's explore the micro brand thing a little bit. I'm kind of curious. So like, what is the idea of like a micro brand to you? Because I kind of agree that it's a packed term now. You know, a few years ago, maybe I would have had a more concise definition for what a micro brand might be, but I think there's a lot of brands that are calling themselves micro brands, and some of them aren't brands at all. They're fly-by-night operations on Kickstarter that, you know, are going to disappear in like 2 years. So, you know, how would you guys identify yourselves?
Well, I mean, I think the Kickstarter thing that you just landed on, it's kind of part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the term micro brand has become so linked to the idea of a Kickstarter brand that if you're not in Kickstarter, or you started on Kickstarter like Etienne did, but he's now not doing that. You know, his brand is growing and it's maturing, and it's that's what Kickstarter is for, in my opinion, is to start a brand, but not to repeatedly, every time you launch a new model, you go back there.
Mm-hmm.
You should be building in your cost structure in an intelligent way that you can like then move your business forward and grow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I have no problem with Kickstarter as a thing for getting capital. But I respect brands a lot more that, okay, once they've taken that first step, they can mature from there and grow. And I feel like, unfortunately, the micro brand term seems to be like somehow like stapled to the brand that sells things that's dirt cheap possible, mm-hmm. and they don't make any profit, and which is why they have to go back to Kickstarter for every single run of their product.
Right, right.
And yeah, anyway, so.
Yeah, I have a similar feeling to that, too.
Yeah.
And I think part of the stigma, you know, is also just that micro brand means inexpensive brand. You know, like, it's not actually the size of the brand and how many people are running it and the amount of employees they might have. Like, there are plenty of extremely high-end independent brands that are tiny, tiny brands, but you would never call somebody who makes $100,000
a micro brand. Yeah, like Ressence, would you call them a micro brand?
Exactly.
I mean, it's a fantastic company.
Similar energy.
But it's like, you know, very small company.
Yeah.
But
so there's like
I would call him an independent brand, you know? I mean,
exactly. It is silly, you know, but it's, if there's any kind of affection for it, and you're like, no, like, screw it. This is the micro brand scene. Like, you know, we're having fun, you know? And I don't know, maybe part of it is the kind of the freedom of it. Like a major brand is kind of this.
My question is like, what is the future of these terms? Because, you know, micro brand was maybe like, I don't know, accurate like 3-4 years ago, maybe, I don't know. It's maybe a little bit less today. And what about tomorrow? Like if we are 10 times the size we are now, are we like be called a micro brand again? Or I don't know. This is, I don't agree with this term as well. Even if I'm respecting, you know, all the people who are saying that we are all micro brands, but I think enthusiasm brand is pretty accurate. All the people are, you know, enthusiasts in the community of watches here. But micro is, you know, for me, the wrong line. It's not the size which count. It's more the fact that there is a different way to build a brand now than before, maybe. So I'm wondering about the future, you know, of this word, kind of.
Yeah, I don't know the exact etymology, but I think it was around in 2008. It was around. And I had assumed it was from, like, you know, taken from microbreweries. Small production, sort of owner-operated.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was just about to say, like, what other industries have, like, a micro...
Yeah, microbreweries, definitely.
So definitely microbrewery.
Which is the thing that people genuinely love. I mean, they love, oh, I love microbrew beers. You know, people have a fridge full of all these different little beer producers.
And look at where that's grown. I mean, now I go into a very commercial grocery store in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, and there's a beer fridge full of, you know, sticker-labeled cans from a local brewery that are $20 for a four-pack. And it's like, you know, that's grown so much, you know, I don't know what they call themselves anymore, frankly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was, I think the term wasn't so loaded back then. I think there was actually affection for the companies that they called microbrands. At least I think so. Maybe they hated all of us. I don't know.
You'll have to go back to the forums and find out.
I think that the people who are like, let's say, the more mainstream watch audience, the kind of people that are more like buying luxury level watches, let's say, in a store, they're the ones I think that kind of have the word microbrand as a pejorative term. And so if you're like a small independent brand that's trying to make a high quality product and you have someone who's, you know, whatever, wearing his Rolex Explorer, I don't know, but they're kind of like, oh, well, that's just a microbrand. There's a certain like dismissiveness about it, which I think doesn't do justice to a lot of the brands that are here, for example, that are producing stuff with incredible quality.
Agreed, yeah.
And a lot of thought. And so that's the only place where I kind of don't like the term, because it seems that to some people, it puts you into this pen of...
Like a subcategory.
Of like kind of bad stuff or something.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you. I think you definitely nailed it, because for a long time, the watch industry was a cottage industry. And what you guys are doing now is not that much different than what brands were doing 50, 60 years ago in certain ways. You were going to the best suppliers, you were getting the best components, and you were putting the watches together based on designs that you guys liked. Actually, I would even say you're more creative now, because back then there were... buying sort of, you know, stock cases and even dials. You see watches all the time with just a different brand name on the dial. So kudos.
It's very true, actually.
Yeah, and also kind of just going back to earlier in the manufacturing, you know, I feel maybe it's almost a little bit that there is a sense of micro as amateur or something. And now you're talking about meeting the major brands, the quality. I mean, I would go so far as to say you've all surpassed them, you know. For the $1,000, $600 price point for like a retail available Swiss major brand watch, you know, we look at them all the time. They're not holding up to the quality of the cases and dials, and certainly not creativity of what is here, you know. So you beat them. The micro brand, it really has kind of flipped a switch. So anyone who says micro brand in a pejorative just hasn't looked in a while.
I think, for sure. You know. Yeah.
But it's pretty cool because, you know, like in Paris, since almost the beginning, we have a showroom where we show our watches to all the people that want to try them. And actually, I think there is a little bit of a switch into the kind of collectors, amateurs that come to see our watches. And I think it's the same for everyone here, because the guy 5 years ago who were collecting, you know, like luxury brands, as you call it, Bradley, well-known brand, you know, they are switching a little bit, I think. They are more and more considering our watches.
Yeah, absolutely.
Proper one, you know. And they are sometimes even switching a little bit, you know, like, I don't want to collect, you know, Rolex and Tudor anymore because it's getting more and more expensive. And it's understandable.
Everybody has it.
And then they switch to something where they find interest, because it's small, because you have to hunt it, you know, you have to find a good one, and there is a new offers, and they find a little bit the new, you know, I don't know, appeal in the watch industry by just digging, you know.
Yep.
And I think in our brands here, people can dig something that they probably like. For bigger brands, it's not the same feeling. And I think there is a switch somewhere right now, which is pretty cool. Yeah. I mean, positive.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So being that you're enthusiast brands, what are some of your challenges? Being that obviously enthusiast brands are generally smaller, there's less sort of hands on deck. So what are sort of the challenges you guys go through day to day that, you know, you'd like to see maybe change in the future?
I personally face no challenges with my company. So you guys go ahead. Everything's smooth on my end.
Yes, I'd like to second that.
I'm going to challenge that.
You're the amateur, so sorry.
Yeah. I do have some challenges, though. I will speak first on that. I would say that for us, the challenge is to be like Jason or Bradley, which is here for some years, you know, so try to see on the long term, which is, you know, there is a lot of people now having the ideas to do watches. So they're going to be more competition a little bit. But I think there is a place for everyone here. Now, the challenge is to, in regards to Baltic, is just to keep doing, you know, what we like. Mm-hmm. And see if the people like them or not. That's it. Mm-hmm. I don't have a crazy 10 years plan, something. It's just a feeling, you know, kind of. We have ideas for, like, we've been designing 3 years collection right now. We see long terms on the in terms of collection. So everything is kind of ready for the three next years. But still, you know, like, for the main, I don't know, thing for the next year, we're going to try to just, you know, do what we've done so far and try to make it better even, mm-hmm. and we'll see.
I lied, I actually do have some challenges, so.
It's okay, you're in a safe place, you can let it out.
It's just us.
It's just us.
Be comfortable.
I think my main goal as a company, and I think, I don't want to speak for other brands as well, but I think I want to not just survive as a brand, I want to thrive, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. involves doing the best job that I can, whether it's design-wise, quality-wise, customer service-wise, after-sales support-wise. So that's that big umbrella from which I work, and it kind of trickles down into specific things. If I had to drill down further, I think number one would be just upping the quality of the watches, maintain some sort of cohesive design. So if you're asking for a specific plan, I don't know. But mm-hmm. I mean, that's basically the driver behind, you know, going along, but just doing the best job that I can.
Mm-hmm. Bradley?
I mean, that's great. I mean, I think that, like Etienne was saying, that the amount of new stuff all the time is probably the biggest thing that's changed, I think, mm-hmm. for me, like from when we started compared to now, the amount of, I don't want to say distraction as a dismissive thing, like, these other brands are distractions or something. No, not like that. But it's true that, you know, there's a lot more new releases of stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more things vying for customers' attention.
For sure.
Whether it's in the automotive space where we are, that certainly there's more little brands that have come up that are doing somewhat similar things. But in general, you know, I think that that level of distraction and variety, and also, again, the, as we've touched on, the variant levels of quality in those things, mm-hmm. creates a much more like busy backdrop for what we're trying to get across as a right. message. So that's, to me, the biggest challenge that I face, is just making sure that like our message is still getting across and our point of view is still interesting to people, and that we're still competitive in terms of like our price point and so on.
Yeah.
So Bradley, do you do that a lot through your design? Is that one of the ways that you kind of get your message across, or is it like a marketing thing, or is it combination?
Well, certainly the design. I mean, I put a lot of passion into the design and a lot of time, as both of you guys do, you know, trying to make something that really is special to me. But it's more like, just for example, like on Instagram, I mean, everyone has Instagram, right? So making sure that people are actually engaging with what you're doing. And also, like, that's another thing. It's like a whole job. Like, no, I mean, I'm doing all this other stuff, right? I mean, all of us are, you know, answering emails, we're shipping stuff, you know, like, and then we also have to try and make sure that we have like an interesting Instagram yeah. and an interesting, I don't send out nearly enough email, for example. Like, I practically send like 4 or 5 emails a year, which is mm-hmm. pathetic, but it's because I hate doing it. And yeah. I don't have time, you know? So those are the things that, again, it's, as a small brand, when you're trying to do everything yourself, or, you know, my wife helps me, but it's not like I have minions that are just doing all this stuff.
Right.
So I think that's like one of the biggest challenges, is just trying to keep your head above the water and like deal with all this stuff and still like create new things and mm-hmm. still like try to top what you've previously done.
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to sort of piggyback off of that and something that you said, and you said like you want to thrive, not just survive, right? Mm. So what does that mean to you? Is it something specific? What is actually thriving?
It is something specific. I think it's creating an object or a thing or an experience that's just beautiful, that people mm-hmm. can appreciate, that you worked hard on, that has some creativity to it, and it's not just lazy. So that's what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, imagery that goes along with your product, or the product itself, or just the customer experience, mm-hmm. it's kind of, you know, experiential.
Yeah.
It's not just a thing that you buy. Cause,
right.
Yes. Know. That's, yeah, I agree.
Well, one of the challenges then for the experience, I think it's also the marketing. I mean, it's weird because since I love watches, you know, I always loved the story behind watches as well. Maybe as much as the watch itself. there is so many cool stories about watches that I think in the experience it's important as well to construct something around the product, images, stories, videos. And that's also a thing that we really try to focus on, because I think it works as a packaging as well, a little bit, you know, a whole package. And I think trying to make stories, of course, considering the quality of the product is like much more important, but making stories around the watch is going to make it a little bit more, I don't know, something that you remember, actually remember. Mm-hmm. This is what we try to do sometimes, more or less. You know, you try, and then you see how it goes. But still, I think it's really important to tell stories. All the brands have done that in the good way. But some of them have just, you know, like the first watch I wanted to have was the GMT Rolex, because I was always interested by being a pilot, you know. Mm-hmm. And the second you put the GMT on your wrist, you feel like a pilot, you know. Mm. And this is what watches are for me, you know. You transpose something, you become another person just having that on the wrist. You put a military watch on your wrist, and then you are, you know, feeling a little bit differently, mm-hmm. you know, like, I don't know.
It's the radium.
Yeah. It's,
I totally agree. It's very true.
Yeah,
very true.
And especially for race, for example, you put a watch like on your wrist in your car, and you're having that feeling that, you know, you're Paul Newman again. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't know, it's strong, you know. A watch is pretty strong for that.
Yeah.
And I think a watch should not be just a product, just itself, but something just a little bit further, you know,
yeah.
A story, kind of. So this is, yeah, one of the challenges we're going to try to do better for the next years. Yeah.
And for me personally, like, I mean, looking at these two guys' brands, for example, Baltic, chatting with Etienne about his connection to watches with his father.
Yeah.
It feels to me really like it's not retro for the sake of being retro, because that's what's in. It's more like a love letter. There's a romance surrounding his brand, sort of. That's what
yeah,
I
thank
feel.
You. Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I mean, I'm a watch collector as well.
Yeah.
Like with your imagery and your design. And with Bradley, when I'm looking at his new watch, it like feels like, man, I'm cruising in a Testarossa, blasting new wave. Just that romance around the watches, I think. Mm-hmm.
I guess since now we've kind of talked about your brands and your challenges and kind of a little bit of your game plans, like, I don't know if you'd comment on just what you are kind of hoping to see from the watch industry at large for the next few years. Are there any trends that you hope to see grow or fade away, anything of that nature?
I'm just kind of interested to see how the process of selling watches will evolve.
I think Etienne
and I were having a long
product, maybe in terms of strategy.
Yeah, I think really we had a long conversation yesterday about that. And, you know, generally I've just been designing something. I show it to a few people that I value their opinions, but like it's basically like just something I think is cool.
Right.
And then I make it, you know, pay for it, and then I sell it. So it's like I like to kind of drop the thing, you know, with no warning. I mean, you know, we don't tease any of our products. We kind of wait until it's done, and then we just show it, and then you can immediately order it. Yeah. But I kind of feel like the nature of the industry is changing, where, you know, like Etienne, we were talking about how he's pre-selling, and then you have to wait for the watch, but you know what you're getting, and you know, and you kind of anticipate that, and it's kind of a big moment when you finally get it. And I think it's very interesting, but it's also, from a business point of view, it's a different approach to how you manage the production. And so I think we can all agree that the old way of like distributors and having tons of stores selling your stuff is not really...
It's not the future.
It's not the future as a small independent brand. And even though we've all probably been in stores and, you know, we have stores selling stuff, but it's not the future. Yeah. And also, yeah, it'll just be interesting to see how the marketplace develops in that respect. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree on that. I think there is a point, we reach a point where the industry is going somewhere different. We don't know exactly where and how, but definitely the proper retail business for me is not the future, you know, it's not going anywhere near that. I mean, they have been there in the same strategy for decades, and it has to change in a way, which is for the good for everyone.
I mean, we're lucky because the big brands, they have all this legacy retailers and authorized dealers
back
all over the world, and those people have to be considered there, you know, and they have like a huge, frankly, a crisis, I would think, of how to deal with that. And there's obviously, there was so much resistance for the big brands and especially the higher end brands to sell online. And now that's finally cracking and they're doing that. But now that kind of hurts their authorized dealers. So we don't have to deal with that problem, thankfully. So we're actually very lucky.
You also don't have to deal with a gray market of your brands either. I mean, granted, that's part of a volume issue, but it's a huge issue for them. And it's part of that legacy retail chain, you know, kind of concept as well.
You know, from the big brands, I would like to see more brands run like Oris, because I think they've been really knocking it out of the park. As far as how they run their company, the people that run it, they're so in touch with the collectors, the watch enthusiasts, and talking with them at events and get-togethers. Just amazing team. VJ and Mark I've met. I've met Rolf as well. Like, I mean, you come away from that conversation thinking these people love watches and they're making watches just for people like us. So I'd like to see the big brands kind of run that way. And they're not like gouging you for like a steel model. Yeah, not mentioning any names.
I feel like one of the things, that like Oris, you know, because I totally agree with you. One of the things they've done, I think they've engaged the enthusiast community and have seen how that has informed their larger strategy as a whole. Because obviously, like something like the Diver 65, I think is very on target for enthusiasts, but it clearly is a mass success. Mm-hmm. But they're not above admitting, I think, you know, that this is because of the trends that have kind of started in other places, and they work, you know, doing a limited edition with Red Bar, for example. Like, I think that's acknowledging it. Whereas other brands have just kind of run with it and been like, no, this is obviously what we were going to do. You know, we were going to have bronze watches and 48, you know, whatever.
But, yeah, and maybe this is naive, like thinking if the big brands were to act more like Oris, they'd put us smaller makers out of business, but I don't think so. I think it just opens up more interest for us to a wider public.
All right, guys. I mean, this was great. I think this is a good place for us to stop. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we sign off?
I just, as I'm doing this, I'm thinking like the nice moment to just reflect on, this is a really exciting time to be doing this. And like, we're really lucky that this is kind of like, who knows what the future will bring, right? Or whatever. But it is a really exciting time to run a small watch brand and to have the support of people like Worn and Wound and, you know, the readers and all the passionate people out there that really love what we're doing as a whole, as a group of people. And, you know, we should savor that, because I think we all get caught up in the moment of, you know, trying to fill orders and, oh, like I got to post something, you know, whatever, you know, and, you know, it's really special what's going on right now.
There is a change somewhere and we might be in the change and actively maybe. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I remember, you know, like a more personal way, maybe. I remember like, I don't know, it was maybe, when was the first wind up? Remind me. That's a tricky question, I see.
I should know this off the top of my head, but so this is the sixth wind-up total. We've had four in New York and two here. Oh, God.
So it was 2015, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'd have to count back, so and it's going to take...
Six or seven, okay.
Yeah, it's been several years.
Because I remember the first one, you know, the first photo report. It was in New York, I guess.
Yeah, it was in New York and it was in Soho, in a little empty storefront.
And I was like, I will pay to be there, you know, having my own dream on the table, selling watches. And it's actually pretty fun to think about it now, because we are now doing the podcast, you know, like few years after. And it's a pretty cool opportunity. And I think that we have to follow our dreams, you know, kind of. So that's pretty cool.
Well said, guys. I think we are making a living making watches. Like, freaking lucky.
Yeah, definitely.
Something I have to get reminded of it sometimes, but just like, we're doing something really cool, really fun, and get to be our own boss, which, you know, at the end of the day is priceless.
Well said.
Yeah, trademark right there.
Edit that out.
And I just want to say, like, and I'm not blowing smoke up your butts, but if it weren't for you guys making good products and interesting products, we'd probably be out of jobs in some ways, because like our website would be really boring, right? Yeah, like we can't write about, you know, solve it over and over again or whatever. Like, I'll cut that part out. That's literally the first brand that popped in my head, but it's also that's like one of the earliest brands. But yeah, it's true. You guys make great products and it makes our website all the better for it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. All right. And on that note, we're off.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn and Wound Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, and don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch? A strap? Don't forget to visit the Wind Up Watch Shop. And of course, head to warnandwound.com daily for news and reviews of great wristwatches. Music tracks Nowhere Land and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.